This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Increasingly, Broadway has been turning to pop music for both inspiration and repertoire. And why not? Pick the hits and the audience will walk into the theater humming the songs in your show. They call them jukebox musicals, and the latest success in that genre tells the story of and borrows from the amazing catalog of Motown. The Detroit label is a legend in the music business and helped transform America. The show is Motown, the musical, and every song in it is a hit because almost every record Berry Gordy ever turned out was a hit. And Motown, the musical, wastes no time in kicking off their show by bringing back the memories. The Motown roster of artists was remarkable, and all of them are represented in song, nearly 50, maybe more, spanning the years and telling Berry Gordy's story of bringing his label to life and changing music forever. Gordy wrote the book, but he chose a York County native to direct the show. Charles Randolph Wright brought the show to Broadway, and now that show's in Charlotte, and Charles Randolph Wright has come home for its opening tonight in the Belk Theater. He joins us for the hour. Welcome.
Good morning.
Welcome back, Usher. You were here a couple of years ago.
Many years ago,
we were trying to figure out when and why you were here.
Only to see you.
Well, thank you very much.
That's why I was here.
No, I know. This actually, I said earlier this morning that this show opens for a week-long run. I'm wrong. It's a two-week run in the Belk Theater tonight at the Blumenthal. You are the director of a Broadway smash hit musical. You're a film director. You are a screenwriter, a playwright in residence at Arena Stage in Washington's American Voices New Play Institute. You've worked in television as a director and as an actor and as a producer. You were on Hill Street Blues and Melrose Place and Falcon Crest, one of my guilty pleasures, by the way, Falcon Crest. And you were in the original Broadway cast of Dreamgirls. But it all started in York County, South Carolina. How?
My family. My mother was extraordinary. When I first went to school, she said, bring an A or an F home. See, there's no C in this family. There is no average. And so I grew up around people who were taught that you could dream, that you could do something far greater than what you would expect in York, South Carolina. So I never had that limitation of, I'm from a small town, I can't do something that I want to do. So I would dream big. And it's thrilling when they actually come true.
But how does a young person in York, and I guess this is in the 50s and 60s, 70s, even know about theater, about acting, about producing, about directing? How do you know? What exposed you to it?
The first show I saw was at Ovens Auditorium. Mm. And
what was it?
Two Gentlemen of Verona.
Wow.
The musical version. I know of all things, right? But my mother was an English teacher, and so she had been reading Shakespeare to me from the time I was a kid. And so it fit into the world that I was in. And when I saw it, I was very aware, because that musical at the time, when they did it in New York, it was a completely mixed cast. It was a Latino, it was a Latino star. The male lead was Latino. The female lead was black. Her father was white. So I'd never seen something like that. And it really affected me, because all the roles were different. And what happened was, when you saw this world, you saw this family, everyone saw themselves at some point on that stage, and it sort of blended into this thing that I'll never forget, because it was a mixture of people, and I didn't know, and I thought that's what you can do in the theater.
We were talking just before we started about you're leaving tomorrow because you're directing a show in Minneapolis.
Yes.
And on stage in that show is this mixture of people.
Yes, it's Keela and the Bee, which is based on the film from 10 years ago, and it's about these kids in a national spelling bee, and they're the main leads. It's a young black woman, a student who's 12, and a Latino man and an Asian man. They're the three finalists.
Is that the way you wrote it, the way it was written, or is that the way you cast it?
That was the way it was written.
Okay.
And the film, that how it's based on a film, and the film had those same characters. So when you see those leads, when you read the headlines every day going to work, when you see something else, you see another, all the issues we deal with, and you walk into this room and you see these kids, and it just gives me such hope. It gives me the hope I had when I was that age, and which I feel I lost along the way. And so now seeing them again, seeing them on stage, what I know that will do for students.
Why did you lose the hope along the way?
Because I kept seeing that there were so many roadblocks. There were so many doors that I felt I had to keep knocking down. And so,
but you did.
So I lost the hope, but I kept driving. You know, I didn't stop doing it.
Why would you? If you knocked on the doors and they slammed them in your face,
right?
Or they let you in and they said, thank you, but no thanks.
Yes.
That'd be one thing.
Right.
But that's not how it turned out for you.
Well, so. That's not how it turned out. But it's like I'd say to people for a long time, you know, you'd get in, you'd finally get your foot in the door, and you find out you're in a waiting room. And so you're then waiting again and again. And, you know, I thought the career that I have, I was very impatient. I thought I would have it years ago. So I'm very grateful that I have it now, because I can deal with it differently than I would have had I been much younger.
So you saw Two Gentlemen of Verona at Ovens Auditorium, but when did you start performing? Because you're a dancer, you're an actor, obviously you're a singer, you were in Dreamgirls, you're a director. When did you start performing?
My first, I guess, indication of art happened at York High School, because I was in the band.
Okay.
So I played trumpet in the band, and the band director, a man named John Bostick, was amazing. He was that kind of ultimate teacher that inspired all these little, you know, we were in this small town, but we had this championship band,
right,
that traveled, that toured, and it showed me what art was. It showed me what art could be and what it does. And the productions we would do with the band were called band review instead of a concert, and we would do production numbers. And that was my first real exposure to that.
How does a concert band do production numbers?
Well, you have the marching band had,
right,
majorettes, you had flag corps and all that.
Right.
So the concert band, that we would have numbers, we would play, it's as if it were a little baby Broadway show. You would have a number in front of that. That was normal to me. I didn't know that most concerts didn't do that.
So, maybe they should.
Maybe they should. It might be more interesting, but it was a way of bringing art to us in a way that was different. Also, a woman who's now a very dear friend of mine, who's an actress here, Polly Atkins, was my French teacher in high school.
And she was a French teacher forever.
Forever. She's not teaching French now.
She's a full-time actress.
She's a full-time actress.
Oh, yeah.
Which she should be. I mean, because she's
wonderful.
She's extraordinary. And she made us do plays. She made us do different things there. And that affected me. That I saw that it was that was something I wanted to do. But again, you think, can I do this? I'm not in New York City. I'm not in this place that's a cultural mecca.
Mm-hmm.
How do I do this? And when I went to Duke, I just started pursuing it. I ended up doing my first play there, and that I was in. I ended up writing a project. So all those things started happening in college. My mom used to say that the pursuit is more important than the dream. So I used to, and I still completely believe that I've been very fortunate that many dreams have come true, but the idea of doing it is what was so important to me. I had a greater fear of not trying something than failing at something.
Really?
Yes. So the not having that attempt, not attempting to do it was failure to me. Actually not getting the dream. At least I tried it. That's success.
Does that go back to your mom saying get an A or an
yes.
F? Failure's not a big deal.
Right.
As long as you try.
As you try. And I say to people about the shows I do, I want you to stand up screaming or stand up screaming. So either so you have, it makes a statement, as opposed to being average, as opposed to being safe. I think so much of what we do, because we want to be successful, because we want to be produced, you end up doing things that remain in the middle. So you can say, oh, let's be safe about this. But I think the work that matters is work that really pushes boundaries on any level.
You were pre-med at Duke.
Yes.
So how does that lead to a show business career?
It does not.
but you could put Band-Aids on injured actors.
Exactly. I can do whatever, which happens often, which happens all too often. My sophomore year at Duke, my roommate had tickets to a show. I was in an organic chemistry lab, and he came up to me and said, listen, I've got these tickets. My girlfriend's sick. Do you want to see the show? And I was like, anything to get me out of this lab. And the show was Pippin, the touring company of Pippin. And I was at the height of my existentialist period, and the show literally changed my life. I thought, if this is something that I can do, I must do it. It just felt, it just resonated. I know people have those, I guess what Oprah calls the aha moment. That was that moment for me.
Is that because Pippin is striving to become somebody or to figure out
and
who he is?
And he doesn't know what he's doing. Right. He can't figure out what to do with his life. Mm-hmm. And then this man of color, which was the Ben Vereen role, is the person leading him through that. He's the leading player who's giving him all these options and taking him on this journey. And again, another image I'd never seen before, that this man who looked like me was the person in charge. And that was thrilling. And so that night, I literally sat on the library steps on East Campus and said, I have to try this. And again, what was instilled in me from a child is like, well, I must go into this. I must do it.
Had you said that your first play that you were actually in was at Duke.
Actually, I did one play in high school. I just forgot about that.
Okay, so, well, high school play, college play.
Right.
Had you taken acting classes?
No.
So when you graduated from Duke, did you go right to New York to try to do
this? Yes, I ended up graduating early from Duke. I got out in December, and I gave myself a deadline. I said, either I get a sign that I should do this, or I'm going to medical school.
What was the sign?
I got the show Pippin.
You got into Pippin?
I got into the show Pippin, which was one of the first. The Broadway production was just closing, and so they started licensing it to other theaters. Uh-huh. And one of the first productions was at a theater in Long Island called Gateway Playhouse. And I ended up getting the leading player in that production and did it that summer.
Tell me how you were equipped. Seriously, to do that at that stage of your life. I don't know how many plays you had done up to that point, but were you nervous about it? Were you confident that you could do it? Were there misgivings on your part? I mean, did you have to be coached and coaxed, and did it have to be pulled out of you, or was it just there?
It was there. And I see that now in actors. I see that when someone walks into a room and they have it.
Right.
And I can't describe what that is except that you feel it. And you know when you see shows, when you are in things, because I know you're a performer as well, that person who walks in and the temperature changes.
Yeah.
You know, it's that thing. So I always had the passion. I didn't know if I had the talent, but I knew I had the passion. And I think right when I first started, you know, the passion sort of was more dominant than the talent.
But obviously the talent was there, because you've gone on to do amazing things, which we will talk about in the course of this conversation. Charles Randolph Wright from York, South Carolina, is with us. He's the Tony-nominated director of Motown, the musical on Broadway, and it opens tonight for 2 weeks at the Belk. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Steinway Piano Gallery, featuring handcrafted Steinway & Sons pianos, Steinway-designed Boston and Essex models, and a selection of pre-owned pianos from various manufacturers. Details at Steinway Piano Gallery, Charlotte.com. Something is happening on college campuses around the country. They're becoming very sensitive. Students are becoming very sensitive to things, well, that they say are very offensive to them. And so some comedians like Bill Maher and even Jerry Seinfeld have stopped playing college campuses because they say the kids have no sense of humor anymore. And now that is beginning to infiltrate into the classroom on what's being taught. And we'll hear more about what one writer calls the coddling of the American mind tomorrow at 9.
on the next Diane Rehm Show. Ongoing fears of a slowdown in the Chinese economy drive a stock sell-off and declines in commodity prices worldwide. What the global market downturn could mean for the U.S. economy, businesses, and consumers.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE Motown, the musical. Musical opens tonight for a two-week run. Charles Randolph Wright is the director of both the Broadway show and this company that is touring around the country, and he's with us today for the hour from York, South Carolina, a guy who grew up in a small town, decided this is what he wanted to do, did a couple of plays.
It's crazy, right?
Graduated pre-med from Duke, goes to New York, auditions, gets a show. This is like, is it Ginger Rogers in Hollywood with a sweater and Schwab's? Is that who this
is? It's
like
so
that.
Ridiculous, isn't it? I know it doesn't. Now looking back, it's so crazy. It's like, how did I do that?
Could it be done today? Because you probably did that what in the 70s?
Yes.
Could it be done today? Could a kid do that today?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. And in a way, they have more options because had I been growing up now, I would be very aware of things because of the internet. I would be aware of what opportunities there were. Mm-hmm. You can actually put a lot of the people and some of the people in Motown we found on the internet because they would, you know, the small kid from York, South Carolina who puts himself on tape on, you know, well, he uses his iPhone and records himself singing and sends it in and we go, oh, we want to see this kid.
I mean, it is amazing the talent on YouTube.
Yes.
That you'd never heard of.
Right.
And they do this in their bedrooms all over the world. And they are amazingly good.
So we've found people that way, you know, and we're always looking for talent, and especially the young Michaels, because the Michael Jacksons in the show are, you know, 11, and they grow out of it instantly. So it's
it's like Billy Elliot, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness. You know, we've been through. I was like, there'll be the Temptation soon. All my other Michaels will end up being Temptations in the show.
And that does happen in this show. But as long as you've mentioned Michael,
yes,
let's hear the young man who plays Michael in the original cast recording. What was his name?
Raymond Luke. I know. I went, oh my God, what's his name? Raymond Luke.
We've been through a lot of Michaels.
We've been through a lot of Michaels.
Since the original. What amazed me about this is that it's Michael. I mean, Michael is a tough role to play, it seems to me. Number five, play it. Let it roll. It's a tough role to play because he's all these people are iconic. And we'll talk about that. But listen to this kid.
Yes.
So, what's the secret here? Because you have to, as you say, these kids grow up fast, their voices change. Then what?
Yes.
I mean, how do you find the next Michael? How do you How do you find a Michael that sounds like and looks like and can move like Michael?
We've had some that don't look as much like Michael, but by the time you get the hair on and in the costume, that iconic costume, that hat, that fringe vest, if it's about the sound and the movement that you can do this. When Raymond walked into, he auditioned in LA and we were auditioning there. And I remember it was a day that I hadn't found a lot of talent that day. I was a little frustrated because the people coming in were okay. Mm-hmm. And he walked in, and when I said about the room, the temperature changing, yeah, this kid walked in, and I went, this is Michael. I mean, it was instant. He had it, the sound, the energy, the look, everything was there. And we've been very fortunate to find them. Our last one who just left the tour was from Raleigh, actually. Huh. There are a couple of, we auditioned in Charlotte last year. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of kids that we have, what now we call the Michael Camp. We have a Michael Jackson camp of kids where we're training different kids. And there's one, there's a kid from here that I really like who was too young for this. And he's sort of, we're grooming him and different mm-hmm. people that we're looking at. So we find them all over the country. We'll do this Michael Camp to see how it is. Because also, It's when Michael comes out in the show, the roof blows off the theater. I mean, I can't imagine being 12 years old and having an audience screaming at you the way they do. It's I've never seen anything like
this. Does the audience scream because they feel they are supposed to because it's Michael Jackson, and that's what people did when Michael Jackson appeared on Ed Sullivan or whatever the show was back in those days when he was singing ABC and
yes.
stuff like that. Or do they do it because these kids are just that good?
I think it's all of it, but our very first preview in New York, the show opens at Motown 25, and they're interviewing Marvin and Smokey, and they come out on stage, and the audience applauds. And I thought, why are they applauding? I mean, that maybe could be Smokey, but they know Marvin is no longer with us. Why are they applauding? Mm-hmm. And there's a T-shirt at the Motown Museum that says, Live It Again, and I understood the T-shirt that night. Because people come in and they literally go back in time. They all have memories of this. No matter where you're from, no matter what color you are, no matter your political persuasion, Motown has this meaning yeah. to people. And they it's in so many of everyone's experience. So I see them revert. I see them have this experience. And I've talked about how we put the show together because it's not just Berry Gordy's journey, and I've never done a show this way, that I realized through him that we had to give the audience room for their memory. So that you'll go into a number and Berry Gordy's falling in love with Diana Ross, but at the same time, you're hearing My Girl, and so you're thinking, I met my wife, I had my baby on this, I mean, all these songs. So you have to have, if it were all book, then you would not be able to have your experience. But then if it's all music, it is just concert. It is just jukebox. So we found out how to weave these stories together, and audiences really take their personal journey, and they take the journey of Motown, which is this true, the story of what happened. They take it at the same time.
A lot of Broadway purists bemoan the Disneyfication of the Broadway musical with all the Disney musicals, which are machines.
Yes.
And they're wonderful, but they are machines.
Yes.
And they also bemoan this incursion into the jukebox with the Jersey Boys, the Four Seasons musical, and ABBA, which is not about ABBA at all, but it uses ABBA's music as the soundtrack, and now this.
Yes.
But what's wrong with that? If you're telling a story, and does it matter that the songs were written for that show or that it was written as a hit record 25, 30 years ago? Does it matter, really?
It doesn't matter. And the thing that it should do, and which I know many people come to Motown who've never gone to a show before.
Sure.
And this might make them go see another show. Well, so why can't you have all these types of shows so we get so categorically pressed into it has to be just this one thing yeah. that a critic or whoever wants. You know, it should be this mixture of work.
The Four Seasons musical is a show that I think brought a lot of people to theater who never saw a Broadway musical, don't even like Broadway musicals.
Right.
They hate the idea of them. But the way they use the music, and I haven't seen Motown yet, but I'm assuming that it's similar to this, the way they use the music in that show to tell the story of the Four Seasons works exactly the way you're talking about. It's telling the story, it's propelling the story forward, but it's also giving you a chance to relive your youth.
Yes. Your Ute, especially from Jersey, yes. Well, also, people often ask, how did we choose these songs? Because they're so, first of all, they're, you know, when I got the script.
How many are there?
I don't know the exact number. It's 50-something, I think. But sometimes it'll be just a line of a song.
Yeah.
So, but when I, the first script that I got from Mr. Gordy had, it had to be 5 hours long. It was like Motown Nickleby. You know, it was, you'd have to that, go to dinner, then have another thing. And you loved every song, right? It's like, I've never worked on something where I couldn't figure out how to cut. Because I loved every single song, yeah. Grew up on every song. And so we really chose the songs by story. Like, what if it doesn't tell the story, we have to cut it. If it's just there for performance.
Hard.
Very hard, you know. And there are performance sequences, so we could use that. Like the Jacksons medley, right, is part of when the Jacksons happen. But the songs were chosen based on telling the story. So that it was an impossible task.
You mentioned you gave a reference to Nicholas Nickleby, and for those people who don't know, that was a production of the Royal Shakespeare Company, I believe, and it was an 8-hour long experience. You had a choice of seeing it on two consecutive days, half and half, or you could see it the whole thing through, beginning in the afternoon, and there was a couple of intermissions, and then you went for a dinner break, and you came back and you did the second half. And I saw it that way, and although my rear end was hurting by the end of the show, it was phenomenal.
It was.
So why not do a musical like that? Why not do it like that? I mean, think about how people would be thrilled with all the music that they would hear.
And especially with this, you can get up and dance, so yeah. it'll help you.
And the reviews that I've read around the country, which are pretty glowing, the only criticism of the thing is that it should have been a miniseries.
Yes.
So you're talking about a miniseries when you're talking about an 8-hour musical. Why not do it?
Well, eventually that should happen. But I know on stage, the thing that happens with theater is it doesn't happen anywhere else, and you do it. You know, it's like there should be a miniseries. And there were, you know, there's the Jacksons miniseries. There have been the Temptations miniseries. So you get that story. But when you have a room full of people who come from all these divergent backgrounds come together and share an experience for 2.5 hours that they really share. Yeah. And it's been mind-boggling. And we've, you know, this has been all over the country. We were in St. Louis when the verdict came, the non-verdict. And we were in St. Louis, and I took...
You're here when the non-verdict came as well.
And so it's like, what is it with this, you know, the kids in the show, and when you see the show, what the end of the first act is the song What's Going On. And almost everywhere they've been, something, I see these young performers, the way it resonates and the way the audience gets it.
You know, it's interesting. You have these young people in the show who probably, although I'm sure they were aware of the music, probably did not grow up the way you and I did, surrounded by that. It was the very part of the fabric of your being, that music at the time. So I'm sure that it's been an education for them, learning about the music, learning about those people who created that music, learning about what Motown did for not only music, but for the culture. And I want to talk about that. But as they learn that, and then they see these events in the real world, it's like history repeating itself.
Absolutely.
I would think it gives them a real insight into things.
It's amazing to watch. And I get emails from them constantly and people all over the country about what this does. Because art can heal. Art can change. And I see this happening with this show.
That's what Motown did.
That's what it did, and I always say that. That's what it did, and Motown the Musical is doing it again, unfortunately, at a time when I did not expect for us to be in this situation again.
You know, Motown changed America. Prior to Motown, there were race records.
Right.
Played mostly on black radio stations, and then there were the covers of those records by white artists played on white radio stations, and you had some teenagers eavesdropping on black radio because it was hip and it was happening, and it was more exciting than the button-down, blow-dried white presentation of all of this. And then Motown comes along, and suddenly everybody is listening to Motown. Everybody is playing Motown. We began to see, hey, you know, there's validity here, and they're not that much different from us, and we're all dancing to the same music, which never happened before.
Right.
How do you explain that? What happened in the zeitgeist that allowed Motown to break through?
Berry Gordy had this vision of just of telling stories through music. He had this vision of the American dream, and he let nothing stop him. That's why I understood him so much. And our relationship has been incredible because of that. I get his story. I get his family. And he just wrote, he said, the truth is a hit. And Motown proved that. And especially in York, South Carolina, my class was the first class that merged. I was in ninth grade when the black school and the white school merged. And I often talk about how, and when we were doing the launch of Motown, I talked about my small town and how, you know, there were riots all over the country and busing and people and fights and people didn't know how to deal with things. I said, but a Motown record would come on and suddenly people would stop. And then they'd start moving a little bit and then they would start singing and then they would start clapping and dancing. And okay, we clapped on different beats, but we would still, we would end up, eventually the beats would come together. So, but I witnessed that so clearly about how music, you know, music with my band background and what our high school band did, music with Motown, what that did, how that changed. And it opened the emotional door of the civil rights movement. That's Motown opened a door that allowed people to go, oh, you know, and the images they saw of the Supremes, these three elegant young black women.
You know, there's a moment in your show where the character playing Ed Sullivan for a brief moment in time introduces the Supremes for the first time on his show, the Ed Sullivan Show, which was a juggernaut on Sunday nights.
Yes.
On CBS back then, and he says, and now, I can't do it, Ed Sullivan, and now, ladies and gentlemen,
that's good.
Let's welcome three colored girls. It was shocking to hear that. Did he really do that?
Yes,
is that
we
how
were
he
researching
did it?
We saw that because I was in all of the archives and doing a lot of research on this, and I thought, oh my God, we must use this because that was the accepted term. That was much better than using another word. So it was, and I thought, oh, we have to use this.
And these people don't understand this. These people, these big, big Motown stars,
yes,
like the Temptations, the Four Tops, the Supremes, etc., they weren't playing Time Warner Cable Arena.
No.
They weren't playing these big arenas that people play today. I used to be at the Steel Pier in Atlantic City in the summer times at the Tony Grant Stars of Tomorrow show. And our theater was right next door to the Music Hall. And the Music Hall showed a movie, and then they took the screen up, and there was a stage show. It was kind of like a vaudeville show because they had a comedian and a juggler and a dance team, and then the headliner would come on. So I saw the Supremes and the Four Tops and the Temptations doing 4 to 5 shows a day.
Yes.
For 7 days. That would never happen today.
No.
But they were consistently incredible.
Impeccable.
Wow. We're going to come back and talk more about that, more about Motown the musical, more about the storied career of Charles Randolph Wright, our guest today on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, making a difference for patients with brain and spine disorders for 75 years. With 45 specialists and 9 offices in Charlotte and the Triad regions, CNSA.com. Ongoing fears of a slowdown in the Chinese economy have been driving a stock sell-off, and declines in commodity prices have been experienced worldwide. So today on the Diane Rehm Show, they'll take a look at the global market downturn and what it could mean for our economy here, for businesses, for consumers, for retirees, for soon-to-be retirees. That's all coming up 20 minutes to 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, now would be your chance. You could email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
The recent explosions in Tianjin, sadly, are sort of China's Katrina. It's an obvious symbol of corruption and incompetence.
It's your community. we help you understand it.
The state audit shows that Community Care of North Carolina is both saving the state money and improving patient outcomes.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. Charles Randolph Wright is our guest today, the director of Motown the Musical.
Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world a better place if you can. Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world a better place if you can.
If I didn't know better, I would think that was Diana Ross and the Supremes, but it's not. It's the cast of Dreamgirls.
We do it all the time.
Of Motown the Musical. You were in the original cast of Dreamgirls, which is loosely based on the Supremes story, I guess. I mean, I think that's what everybody's taking away from it. Was that, in fact, what it was based on?
I think so. But at the time when we did the musical, I think the film especially sort of skewed it to more toward Motown and the Supremes, and because of the look, because of everything visually. But the actual stage show, they came from Chicago. They were from different, it was every group. And my friends were in LaBelle. They came to see the show and they said, oh, that's our story. The group, the Three Degrees, came to see the show there. That's our story. Cause almost every, you know, every town had that girl group. Mm-hmm. They had the Temptations. They had that kind of thing. And I think the whole difference in Motown is that Detroit had Berry Gordy, because every town had that talent.
Right.
And it's what Berry Gordy did. And as a child, I remember talking to my mom about this when I first got the show. I was obsessed with Berry Gordy as a kid because I'd never seen someone of color to have this company this way, to have this huge company, this presence, what the work he did. I was fascinated by it. I mean, I wanted to be Michael Jackson, of course, at first, and then my voice changed. So then I had to, you know, go move on. So I moved on to Jermaine, but eventually it was, Berry Gordy was fascinating to me because of what he did and how he did it. And years later, being able to work hand in hand with him and having the relationship I have with him, which has been one of the greatest relationships I've ever had working, it's been amazing.
Let's talk about the process. Berry Gordy based this, he wrote the book for the musical.
Yes.
And he based it on his book, To Be Loved, The Music, The Magic, The Memories of Motown. How long had he been working on the musical, the book of the musical, before you came on the scene?
I think it's almost two decades that he had talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long he had actually worked on the musical. The actual script that I had, I think had only been in process a couple of years. But he had thought about it for years and then didn't do it, and thought about it and had gone down the road with different people but didn't do it. And so finally he felt it was time. And when the two of us started working on it, everything just clicked.
Well, according to an article I read in the Observer this weekend with Larry Topman, who's the theater critic, who's a great guy, and he really knows what he's writing about, he says, and I hope I didn't jinx this by saying he knows what he's writing about, and you're going to correct him now, said that you really kind of had to put the full court press on Berry Gordy to let you direct this show. Is that true, and why?
Well, he came to New York and met almost every director, all the top directors in New York. And I was one of the people he met. And I've worked on Broadway before, but I'd never directed a huge show. I mean, this is.
You did Porgy and Bess.
But
you
it was
Guys and Dolls.
But they weren't Broadway shows from, you know,
ground
from
up.
Scratch, from ground up. You know, okay. Both of those were name shows. So you think, oh, it's not easier to do them, but this is something creating from the ground up.
Right.
And so, and although I've done so many new projects, this was, I mean, the people around him, I think, had more of a concern than he did. Mm-hmm. And that's when I didn't even realize it because he actually wrote this recently when he said about me coming to meet him. And he said, but, you know, you've never done a big Broadway musical before. And I said, neither have you. And so, and he was like, this is it. That's it. And, immediately, I just understood when our first day of working, he said to me, my favorite show is Pippin. And I just went, what? Because I've had this circle with this show my entire career. And I forgot Pippin was on Motown. And,
yes.
Right?
Broadway cast recording was on Motown.
The original recording was on Motown. And it turned out Berry Gordy was the single biggest investor in Pippin. The show was not going to happen. Suzanne DePass brought Stephen Schwartz to him, played these songs. He loved Corner of the Sky, had the Jacksons sing it. Oh. And all of the groups actually sang songs from Pippin. And he was an investor in that show. So our lives have been intertwined that way in every possible way. It's that.
He started Motown, I read, with $800 and a dream and a great appreciation for artists.
Yes.
And helping them to realize their potential and bloom. And he had the ability to see them or hear them in a way other people perhaps did not. And just kind of had this talent, this knack for helping them choose material and stage their acts, etc. Is that kind of how he dealt with you? Because this is his baby.
Yes.
This is his story. It's his script, and when a director comes in to build a show from the ground up, you're changing the script. You're
Yes.
molding things. You're moving pieces around. You're taking things out. You're putting things in. Was it difficult for him to give up that control to somebody else?
Not when he trusts. When he trusts you, he'll give you – he makes you better than you are. He pushes you to be the best you can be. So – I was very comfortable with him. People said, aren't you nervous? And I said, no, I can't sleep, but I'm not nervous because I was born to do this. This is something I know. I know every aspect of this. Everything I've ever done, starting with Dreamgirls up to this, led me to this moment of being able to know because I've been a performer and I'm a writer and I knew every aspect of this. So I was very comfortable and he saw that. He felt that. His instincts, he has the greatest instincts I've ever seen. He knows more about entertainment than all of us combined.
Kevin McCollum, who's the producer of
Yes.
this show and who's been on this show before and he worked with Rent and Avenue Q and In the Heights, said,
Yes.
He says that Brian Epstein is referred to as a genius because he discovered and nurtured the Beatles.
Right.
He said, what does that make Berry Gordy?
Exactly.
Who gave us Diana Ross and the Supremes, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, the Temptations, Marvin Gaye, the Jackson 5, Stevie Wonder, and on and on and on. I mean, this guy is amazing when you come right down to it, isn't he?
Yes. And it's that thing of
So why weren't you nervous?
He gave me permission, and that goes back to me being in York, South Carolina, and my mom, and my band director, and Polly Atkins. And when I went to Duke, I had a freshman English teacher who actually now is the chaplain at Queens. And I took this, of course, existentialist view and literature course in college, and she made me write an existentialist musical for my final. She just saw it in me and she said, no, you need to do this. Cause I would always talk about music and influences. This woman named Diane Mowry and Diane, all these people gave me permission to do what I wanted, to live the life that I thought I could live. And Berry Gordy did that. He gave these artists permission to soar and gave them a space and room to discover who they were and how to become the greatest artist you could be. And he would challenge them. You know, in the show, you'll see Quality Control was where they would all meet and play music and they would play a song and they would vote on the song.
Hmm.
And he always says that, you know, competition breeds champions. If you can prove to him that he's wrong about something. So we would have these, not fights, but we would have these great arguments about things. And he was like, challenge me. See if, and it would be, I'd be in the middle of this thing with him trying to say, this doesn't work, you know, this whole thing. And he'd say, and I'd think, oh my God, I'm fighting with Berry Gordy. So to have that, when you're given permission, that's a great gift.
You're telling the story of Motown and, it also seems to me that you are reminding people of the impact that this record label had, not on just on music, but on society. And Motown was around as a major force for a long time. So the style of music changed in the
yes.
course of that. And what they focused on and how they commented on what was happening in our world in America
right.
changed over time. I put together a little medley that will give you a kind of the scope of Motown from its early days into when things began to shift a little bit and become a little bit more political.
And now, Chicago, with their hot new hit, let's hear it for the Marvelous Marvelettes.
So many things, because Motown went through the assassinations of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, the Vietnam War,
right.
the fight for civil rights, and kind of subliminally was part of the fabric of all of that.
And that's actually all in the show,
yeah.
too. But the way we do it is subliminal. It is what it felt like. When we opened in L.A., Sidney Poitier came to see the show, and I was talking to him after. I'll say that again. I was talking to him after, and he said, this was the greatest theatrical experience he'd ever had. He said, because that was my life, and it was the way that I had to do it. He said, because it wasn't, we couldn't do anything that was obvious.
Yeah.
It was all underneath and around, and it was extraordinary. And the people, because I've met Smokey, Stevie, you know, Diana. I mean, it's been they all came to opening night. They've been to the show so many times, and that's the greatest to compliment that the people who lived it say, "This is how it is. This is how it was."
You know, it would seem to me that this show provides you with incredible challenges and a major decision to make. And I'd like to know how you made it and what decision you actually did make, because these people are iconic.
Yes.
When you hear these songs, you don't want to hear them from anybody
right.
else but the people who did them. And you're bringing in Marvin Gaye and Michael Jackson and Smokey Robinson and Stevie Wonder and Gladys Knight and Mary Wilson and Martha Reeves and Diana Ross. Are you telling the actors who are performing these people to do their impression of them, or is it supposed to be an impression? Or are you just giving the feeling of those people? Did they go back and watch hours of tape on what they looked like, listen to hours of music to what they sounded like? Are they trying to recreate that? Or are they being themselves in the context of the show somehow?
Perfect question. I tell them they must evoke people
okay.
and not imitate them, because if you imitate them, it will never work. But what is it about these artists that made them icons? What is it that they do? how they look, how they feel. What is it in you that you have that connects to that? And the great secret weapon I had was Berry Gordy, because he knew them before they became icons. So there are things that he knew to say, that he knew something about. I remember working on something with the Diana Ross character, and he was like, that's the wrong key. It needs to be lower for her because it has to be right at this certain point in her voice. I mean, there are things that he just knew to do that none of us would know because he went through it already.
Yeah.
And we were able. So it's about, yes, people who have a look that a certain feel, but it's really evoking them and honoring them as opposed to imitating. Yeah. Doing the imitation show as a cop, that's the last thing I wanted any of them to do. And that's what this company, the Broadway company, they do so well, because they become these people to the audience.
Charlotte from Matthews wants me to have you expand on how the music in this show is healing. And you have said that in the past that the music has the power to change, to encourage, to heal.
When you sit there in an audience with, and I love this show because everyone, it's such a mixture of people that come to the shows. Broadway is a very white community typically. And when I would see every age, every color, every type of person come to the show, when you sit there and hear this music, you realize that we have much more in common than we have that's separate. And that's the great... Motown was called the sound of young America, not the sound of black or Detroit America. It was the sound of young America. It still is.
We're out of time. That means we won't get to talk about the musical you're developing with B.B. Winans.
Born for This.
Pardon me?
It's called Born for This.
Okay, and
yes.
Where are you in that process?
We will open in the spring in Atlanta, and it's about here. It happened in Pineville, North Carolina.
I know.
It's too bad we didn't talk about it. I'll come back and talk about it.
Okay, you're welcome to come back anytime. Charles Randolph Wright, the Tony-nominated director of Motown, the musical that opens tonight, runs for 2 weeks at the Belk.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.